This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Their food has all been washed away in the flooding. Access to clean drinking water is a real challenge. But MSF, what we're trying to do, we did a really quick assessment of all of the five schools there. So we're addressing the issue of access to clean drinking water.
That's Ian Thompson, Project Director of Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, talking about the flooding in northeastern Kenya that has cut off access to the Dadaab refugee camp. Details coming up. Also, the Israeli-Hamas deal for a four-day ceasefire and the release of some hostages delayed until tomorrow. And President William Ruto says Kenya is ready to privatize 35 state companies. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Israel's national security advisor said the release of hostages under a temporary truce agreement with Hamas will not happen before Friday. It is expected that at least 50 hostages will be freed by Hamas during a four-day ceasefire under a new deal with Israel brokered by Qatar and the United States. In exchange, Israel will release 150 prisoners who were indicted for their previous involvement in terror activities, a deal the Council General says was made with a heavy heart. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the war against Hamas after the truce expires, with the goal of destroying the group's military capabilities, ending its 16-year rule in Gaza, and returning all of the estimated 240 captives held in Gaza by Hamas and other groups. For the latest from the region, we have reporter Linda Gradstein standing by in Jerusalem. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you so much, Yehiyas.
So why the delay, Linda?
Well, it's not exactly clear why the delay. I've sort of heard two versions of this. One is that it was just kind of procedural issues. The other was that Hamas is insisting that the released hostages go to Egyptian hospitals and not be taken by the Red Cross directly to Israel, and Israel is insisting that they go directly to Israeli hospitals. It appears that's been ironed out, and they will be taken to Israeli hospitals. But there's something a little strange about the timing. A spokesman for Qatar's foreign ministry said that the ceasefire will start at 7 a.m. local time tomorrow, and the first group of 13 hostages would only be freed 9 hours later at 4 p.m. Now, until now, Israel has said that the ceasefire won't actually start until the first group of hostages are freed.
And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as I just said, had vowed to continue the war against Hamas after the truce expires, with the goal of destroying the group's military capabilities. Is that a good incentive? I mean,
well, I think, you know, the idea is that during this ceasefire, a large amount of aid will be able to come into Gaza, food, fuel, medicine. Right now, more than 1 million people have left northern Gaza, and so southern Gaza is now hosting 2.2 million people, and the conditions are getting really, really bad. Look, I think the idea is that the hostages would be freed. Hamas would have a break. Israel says that if Hamas surrendered, it would stop fighting. But Israel, I think, says that it won't stop until Hamas can no longer be a military threat. I think that what happened on October 7th, what's called Black Saturday here, the Hamas massacre of 1,200 civilians, was such a shock to Israelis that they feel that the only chance for any kind of an eventual peaceful solution between Israelis and Palestinians is if Hamas is not part of the picture.
And at last, we've heard from Pope Francis, who actually, in an unscripted remark yesterday, said, you know, that both sides are suffering during meetings with the Israeli relatives of Hamas-held captives and with Palestinians who have families in Gaza. And this is, he said, what wars do. Has that resonated in any way with both sides?
Well, first of all, one of the people who met the Pope is my friend Rachel Goldberg-Poland, whose son Hirsch is believed to be one of the people who was kidnapped. His arm was blown off at his at the elbow, and for, you know, 7 weeks she has not known if her 23-year-old son is alive or not. And he would not be part of this hostage release in any case, as the 50 hostages that we're talking about in this first 4 days is only women and children. That said, I know on the Israeli side there was some disappointment that the Pope kind of seemed to make the two sides equivalent. In other words, from the Israeli perspective, Hamas started the war. Israel didn't start the war. And so to sort of compare them, I think from the Palestinian side, the Pope's remarks were welcomed. As you and I have talked about repeatedly, there's been a tremendous amount of destruction in Gaza. In fact, you know, they're not sure once the fighting ends where people will be able to go back home to, those who live in northern Gaza, because whole neighborhoods have been destroyed.
And talking about pressure from the international community, now Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has urged leaders of the world's 20 big economies to do whatever necessary to ensure the Israeli-Hamas conflict does not expand into a wider conflict.
Right. There's definitely concern about expansion to a wider conflict. Look, Egypt's economy is already suffering. Tourism to the Middle East has basically stopped. You know, when these kinds of things happen, even if it's localized between Israel and Hamas, tourism to Israel has completely stopped. So I think there is definitely concern that it could spread. I know in Israel, you know, I was just listening to the radio, and some of those evacuated from communities near Gaza, the government is paying for them to stay in hotels, but there is not covering their, you know, other expenses, and small businesses are on the verge of closing. And I think that's happening really all over, you know, the Middle East. And there's definitely concern of sparking a global crisis.
Linda Granstein, briefing us on the latest from the region. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As reported, Israeli attacks continued today inside the Gaza Strip after an agreement to pause hostilities was delayed while negotiators worked to resolve final details, according to officials in Israel and Qatar. And today, Qatar announced the pause would begin Friday local time, and the first group of hostages of 13 women and children would be transferred Friday afternoon. More groups are expected to be released over the next 4 days. Israel government spokesman Ilon Levy told VOA's Carol Van Damme in part two of their exclusive interview, the four-day pause is meant to facilitate the evacuation of Hamas hostages from Gaza, and that the hostages taken are from several countries, including at least one from Tanzania. The Tanzanian government confirmed the death of 22-year-old Clemence Felix Matenga, an agricultural intern who was believed to have been kidnapped in Israel during the terrorist attack carried out by Hamas. His body is expected to arrive in Tanzania on Friday. Levi says the pause was never meant to be considered a ceasefire.
There is no ceasefire. The war continues. What we have now is a temporary cessation, a temporary four-day pause in order to facilitate an evacuation of 50 hostages. The arrangement we have now is to get 50 hostages, women and children. And we're going to try to get those 50 women and children out. And then we're offering Hamas a choice. For every 10 additional hostages it releases, we will give another one-day pause in the fighting. But after that is done, we will continue with all force to continue to put pressure on Hamas to release all of our 240 hostages. There will be no one left behind. And we will continue. This war will end with the end of Hamas.
And on the hostages, how many of those hostages are African? Do you know?
Not off the top of my head, but I can find the numbers for you. The October 7th massacre was a crime against humanity, not only against the Israeli people, but there are nationals of 26 countries who are being held hostage in the Gaza Strip right now. Nationals of over 42 countries who were either murdered, abducted, or injured on that terrible day. And we're doing everything we can to bring everyone home. Everyone. No one will be left behind.
Have African governments contacted your government, asking them about securing their safety?
Of course, we've been in contact with all our international partners and want to make sure that we get everyone out. Just recently, I believe, we reported the death of a poor Tanzanian exchange student who had been in Israel and abducted on that day, together with nationals of so many other countries, simply ripped out of their beds on that awful morning of October 7th and abducted into the Gaza Strip in the most brutal way. And of course, there's no excuse for this.
What's your government's reaction to South Africa shutting down its embassy in Israel and accusing your government of war crimes and genocide?
Look, a genocide took place on October 7th. It was an act of genocide perpetrated by Hamas. Now, look, we know that we are fighting the most moral fight imaginable. We are fighting to destroy the monsters who perpetrated the most deadly massacre of Jews since the Holocaust and are promising to do that again. And this is a moral test for humanity. Are you with humanity or are you with savagery? We know that we're on the right side of history, and anyone who doesn't stand with us is standing with the people who on October 7th burned, beheaded, abducted babies. And if you want to take the sides of those evil terrorists, history is going to judge you, and history will judge you harshly.
A lot of people would say what's happening in Gaza right now is savage.
We are targeting Hamas. This isn't a war with the Palestinian people. It's not a war with the people of Gaza. It's a war with Hamas. And that's why we've been doing everything we can to get civilians out of harm's way. We could have gone in all guns a-blazing on October 8th. Instead, we gave a month for civilians to get out of harm's way because we don't want them to be hurt.
That is Israeli government spokesman Elon Levy speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Jerusalem. The three refugee camps that make up the Dadaab complex in Kenya's northeastern province are home to more than 300,000 refugees, most of whom fled neighboring Somalia. Doctors Without Borders, known as MSF, says heavy rainfall in the area has caused large-scale flooding and cut off access to Dadaab, leaving many refugees without shelter, clean drinking water, and food. Ian Thompson, project director at MSF, tells me the flooding poses significant health risks in the camp.
The El Nino has caused extremely heavy rainfalls in the northeast. And what we've seen in the northeast, north of Garissa, there's a main road that goes from Garissa that takes you up to the other three counties north of Garissa. And the main road has been completely cut, and it's the only way in or out of the northeast provinces. And they rely on everything by road: food, fuel. The markets are depleting. The sanitary conditions are awful. And in the Dadaab refugee complex, there are certain areas within it. The refugees themselves are being flooded out. And we're seeing them displaced to schools. The schools themselves are really struggling to cope with the influx of these displaced people. Extremely poor sanitary conditions. Their food has all been washed away in the flooding. Access to clean drinking water is a real challenge. But MSF, what we're trying to do, we did a really quick assessment of all of the five schools there. So we're addressing the issue of access to clean drinking water. We are dealing with the latrines as we speak. We've set up a team, and they're ensuring that all these households in the schools have access to at least a toilet. We're making sure that even though they're displaced, that all of these displaced people have access to healthcare. One of the greatest needs, unfortunately, is not being met is access to food. That's a real challenge because these refugees in the Dadaab complex rely on donations from organisations like WFP. And unfortunately, WFP themselves are struggling. MSF, what we're trying to do is advocate to other partners, other organisations that can try and address this problem, because right at this moment, no one's going to give these people food until at least the beginning of December, which is completely unacceptable.
So, Ian, so if the roads are cut off, then what are we talking about? Airdrops? How can help come to the camp?
Yeah, that's it. The only way at the moment is by air. And so organizations like MSF, we've organized non-food item distribution for each of the households. And this is shelter, blankets, it's cooking utensils, it's mosquito nets. So that's happening today. And I will beat the drum again. The one need that is not being met is the food need. And this, it has to come in by air. There's no other way possible. And it doesn't look like this road, this main road from Garissa, is going to be fixed anytime soon.
How many refugees are we talking about here? The number in the three or four refugee camps that make up the Dadaab complex?
Yeah, so the whole Dadaab complex, it houses over 300,000 refugees that have been stuck there for many, many years. In Dagahale refugee camp, you're talking about something like 4,000, 5,000. In Hagadera refugee camp, we have figures of 20,000. In the other refugee camps, I'm not aware of the figures at the moment. There is other agencies that are on the ground that are more aware of these figures.
Ian, and as you are aware, the prolonged lack of access to clean water increases the likelihood of waterborne diseases.
Yeah, we're acutely aware of this, thank you. And this is one of the main reasons we're dealing with the access to health, access to clean drinking water and access to latrines. When we did the first assessment, there was clear evidence that there was open defecation. Open defecation combined with stagnant water, combined with not good access to clean drinking water, is all indicators that the next thing to come, issues related to poor sanitation, poor drinking water, etc. You know, things like cholera. Only last year, MSF responded in the Dadaab refugee complex to a 10-month, so a very protracted cholera outbreak. And we had our cholera treatment centre up and running for 10 months. So if we don't deal with these, your latrines and access to health, to clean drinking water, then we're likely to see waterborne diseases. We're likely to see other issues related to stagnant water, like where the mosquitoes can multiply, and then you're going to end up with increased malaria. So you know, it has all the hallmarks of a long-term health issues within the Dadaab refugee complex.
That was Ian Thompson, project coordinator for MSF. He spoke with me from Nairobi. First, some families fled drought and violence. Now, they say they have nowhere to hide from intense flooding. As rainfall exacerbates by the weather phenomenon El Niño, pummels East Africa, including large parts of Somalia. Among the worst-hit towns is densely populated Beldawin, where the Shebele River burst its banks, destroyed many homes, and caused thousands to flee to higher ground near the border with Ethiopia. Somalia's federal government declared a state of emergency in October after extreme weather exacerbated by El Niño destroyed homes, roads, and bridges. And El Niño is a natural, temporary, and occasional warming of part of the Pacific that shifts weather patterns across the globe, often by moving the airborne paths for storms. El Niño hits hardest in December through February. Some scientists believe climate change is making El Niño stronger. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Kenya's President William Ruto says his government is ready to privatize 35 state companies in a bid to boost productivity. The government last month signed a revised privatization bill into law that makes it easier to sell state enterprises to private companies. It aims to increase the private sector's participation in the economy. Ruto says the government is also exploring options for some 100 state-owned firms, saying many would-be lucrative companies are trapped in government bureaucracy when the services they are offering can be better offered by the private sector. Every year, on the fourth Thursday in November, Americans celebrate Thanksgiving. It's a commemoration of the 1621 harvest feast, when the colonists who came from England shared a friendly meal with the land's native people. But how much of the Thanksgiving story is true? VOA's Dora Mahuquar visited Plymouth, Massachusetts, the site of the first Thanksgiving, to separate fact from fiction.
This is Plymouth, Massachusetts, where the first Thanksgiving took place. A few miles away is a living history museum, where the Pilgrim way of life and Thanksgiving traditions...
Do you like to eat duck, Evan?
...are recreated for visitors. Malka Benjamin is the director of colonial interpretation at Plymouth Patuxent Museums.
I have lots of cooking to do to get ready, for the men have brought back turkeys and ducks and geese.
The Wampanoag, the indigenous people who shared the first Thanksgiving with the English colonists, are also represented.
Look at that.
Wampanoag tribe member Melissa Costa oversees the exhibit.
Wampanoag people are still here. I want them to think of Wampanoag people as not just in the past, or even indigenous people as in the past, but as in the present, still making their way, still teaching the public.
Native people traveled.
Richard Pickering, the museum's chief historian, says the first Thanksgiving was marked by mutual respect.
Ultimately, what happens in Plymouth in the fall of 1621 is the highest level of diplomacy.
The Wampanoag, who today have a small reservation nearby, made an alliance with the Pilgrims. They even helped the newcomers survive a harsh second winter by teaching them how to plant crops and live off the land.
We should not be projecting any kind of distrust, animus, on that event.
How the two sides ended up sharing the meal is unclear. Tribal citizen and educator Paula Peters says the Pilgrims fired guns, which the Wampanoag came to investigate.
At some point they decided, oh, this isn't a threat. They're just celebrating their harvest. And guess what? We're all here now, so we're all going to eat.
Corn, beans, and squash. There's maize. Also the standing dish of New England, stewed pumpkin.
Historians and others make educated guesses about what was eaten during the three-day feast.
The Wampanoag did go and get fowl, which may or may not have been turkey, some cranberries, because that was the fruit of the season.
There is shellfish there as well. There is fish.
And we know that there was deer.
What is not in dispute is the history of upheaval and destruction Native Americans suffered once more white colonists arrived.
They want their land. They want them off that land. And so you see a changing attitude from one of admiration to one of stereotyping and derision. And it's that kind of thought that enables them to want to push them off the land with no sense of guilt.
The Pilgrims originally came to America in search of religious freedom, but apparently not for all, says Peters.
They sacrificed so much for religious freedom, but they didn't offer that same grace to the indigenous people who lived here to begin with.
Like many Americans, Peters and Costa plan to spend Thanksgiving with family, but they'll also be thinking of the sacrifices of their ancestors.
Because bark in the spring is full of sap.
Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Plymouth, Massachusetts.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.